You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Catch up on the latest episodes of The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Ears Edition. Trevor Noah and the world's fakest news team tackle the biggest stories in news, politics, and pop culture. It's like The Daily Show, but for your ears only. Studies show ears are great for listening, and who are we to deny science? Tune in to The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, Ears Edition, for highlights and extended interviews, available Tuesday through Friday mornings on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, or wherever you can get your ears on a podcast. Millions of people face legal problems every year. Take control of your rights with Legal Shield for help on a variety of legal issues, such as preparing a will or fighting a speeding ticket. As a Legal Shield member, you'll pay an affordable monthly rate for access to an entire law firm instead of hefty hourly fees. Get the legal protection you deserve. Visit LegalShield.com and put a law firm in the palm of your hand today with Legal Shield. And now, enjoy the show.
Nicholson, you could think of him.
Yeah,
he could do great. He'd be a great Hamlet, just like neither a borrower nor a lender be. And the t-shirts keep for thine self.
These are obscure references, but we must.
We throw him in just to keep the audience.
Shakespeare said, was it not him that said, kill all the lawyers first, but of course there were no agents then.
That's right. Who knew?
Who knew? 10%. My lord must give up that check for not feeling this. Carpe per diem sees the check, and yet Neil Bush still works. Why?
That was a 1991 clip of Robin Williams appearing on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. From his rapid-fire stand-up comedy riffs to his breakout role in Mork and Mindy and his Academy Award-winning performance in Good Will Hunting, Robin Williams was a singular, innovative, and beloved entertainer. But Williams' comic brilliance masked a deep well of conflicted emotions and self-doubt, which he drew upon in his comedy and in his celebrated films like Dead Poets Society. He struggled mightily with addiction and depression, topics he discussed openly while performing and during interviews, and with a debilitating condition at the end of his life that affected him in ways his fans never knew. Now, New York Times culture reporter Dave Iskoff paints a compelling portrait of him in a new biography titled Robin. And today, Dave comes on the podcast to talk about Robin Williams' surprisingly patrician upbringing, his time studying to be a serious actor at Juilliard, and his early influences as a comedian. Dave reveals how Star Wars helped Williams land the role of Mork the Orc, and why his shenanigans on Mork and Mindy might have landed him in hot water in the age of Me Too. He discusses Robin's gradual evolution as a movie star, and why at first, Hollywood didn't really know what to do with Robin Williams. Then Dave shares how John Belushi's overdose scared Robin Williams straight, what eventually caused him to fall back into addiction some 20 years later, and how a rare disease led to his tragic suicide. Plus, he recalls his favorite personal encounters with the comedian, and why he always wanted to give total strangers what he called an authentic Robin Williams experience. Coming up with New York Times culture reporter Dave Iskoff in just a moment. Dave Dave Iskoff is a culture reporter at the New York Times, where he writes regularly about film, television, theater, music, and popular culture. He's the author of Mad as Hell, Cocaine Sun, and Lads, as well as a new book, which is being called the definitive biography of one of the great entertainers of all time, Robin Williams. And it's received praise from the likes of Steve Martin, Amy Poehler, and Patton Oswalt. It's called Robin. Dave, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you for having me on.
You interviewed Robin Williams a few times over the years and followed his career. Did you come into this project thinking that you had a pretty good idea of who he was and what drove him? And did those assumptions hold up as you began writing this?
In some sense, they did, because the period in his life when I was writing about him and getting to speak to him, he'd been through, I think, a lot of difficult events already by that point. He had had his relapse into alcoholism and been to rehab to get sober. He had had a pretty painful divorce from his second wife, Marcia. And then he was trying to get started with, you know, what would end up being his last stand-up tour, which he called Weapons of Self-Destruction. And then just a few days into that first attempt is when he started having heart problems, breathing problems, and they discovered that he had a broken heart valve and had to have the surgery to repair that. So writing about him in that period, he was fairly open and fairly candid about just a lot of the troubles in his own life, certainly with the alcoholism, very honest about things that he felt he had done to people while he was abusing, drinking, and why he felt it so crucial that he get clean and you know, maintain his sobriety. So when somebody, I think, is that open about themselves, you already have a pretty good sense of him. I mean, not to say that there weren't things that I learned that were fascinating and interesting and unexpected, but I think the sort of core idea of him as, I think, a person who if nothing else, was pretty aware of his own humanity and his own, his own fallibility. That I think remained constant.
It's been 4 years almost since Robin's death, and I remember when it happened, people were so shocked and eager to make sense of it that kind of the knee-jerk reaction was this trite, sad clown take on Robin Williams. But as you talk about it in the book, it sounds like he was a lot more complex than that. And even to those who knew him best, he was a little bit of an enigma, or they only, as you say, they only saw parts of him, I guess.
Yeah, it's a kind of recurring thing that people would say, even family members, even people that he was as intimate as one could be, that people felt like they got most of him, but that nobody got all of him. There was always something or some part that he was kind of holding at bay. And I understand the sort of, I mean, as you were calling it, the sort of the knee-jerk or the cliche of, you know, somebody who is, you know, outwardly joyful or making other people laugh, but inwardly hurting. But and there, I mean, there's certainly some truth to that. But he was, I think, just an extremely sensitive and empathetic person throughout his life, and it made him a great comedian. It made him a great actor, and you know, it just also made him, I think, just very attuned to you know, what was going on inside of himself and inside of in the world around him. And I think when you're that aware of the world, it puts a burden on you.
When you're interviewing people and you kind of get little snippets of him from different people, was the process of researching this book a little bit like trying to piece together who Charles Foster Kane was?
I mean, there's no, I wish there were like one artifact at the end that, you know, explained everything that I could see.
Or the suspenders, the rainbow suspenders.
Yeah, I mean, if there is, I mean, maybe it's the toy soldiers from his childhood. You know, you want to, you know, like if you could save Rosebud before it went into the fire, that's maybe the closest example. But It's true. I mean, the process, certainly the research and the reporting process was very much like a little bit of a detective story, just in that, you know, you talk to one person, they turn you on to somebody else, you seek out that person, maybe there's a dead end or somebody who isn't interested in talking. You just keep getting suggestions, you keep hearing about other people in stories. I was very fortunate that, in particular, Robin's older son, Zach, was willing to talk to me and spent time with me and turned me on to some really special sources in terms of the family history, that the family itself had had a book made just for their own reference. It was never sold. They hired a historian to basically like trace the history of the Williams family and the McLaurin family, which is his mother's side of the family. Mm-hmm. So I essentially had this book to work from that already told a lot of the prehistory of the family. And Zach also helped connect me to other surviving relatives of Robin. So that was a huge, huge foundation to build on. But there was still a ton of work and lots of other people to seek out beyond that.
Yeah, and I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but you close the book with this great story about a time that Robin invited you to go comic book shopping with him.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, because I think it gives a little window into how he related to people.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of saved that for the very end because this isn't a book about me, and I didn't really want to insert myself as a character or anything, but I did at least want to give people a sense of here's what it was like to engage with him even for a little bit. And it was, you know, during that same period that I was telling you about when I wrote this particularly long feature about him for the New York Times. And in the course of just interviewing him for that, in one of our conversations, I mentioned to him, we sort of discovered about each other that we were both big into comic books. And he knew that I was from New York, or I mentioned it to him, and I told him that, you know, I like to go shopping at a store there called Forbidden Planet. And he says, oh, that's where I go when I'm in New York. And, you know, the next time I'm in town, I'll take you there. And I mean, it was very flattering, but I also just thought, you know, particularly when you, you know, you interview celebrities, people say things like that it's just
right. Let's get lunch sometime. Let's hang out. Yeah, no follow up.
A little chit that they, you know, maybe they're trying to butter you up, make sure that you write a nice story about them, but then they never intend to follow through on. But in this case, he did. Several weeks later, he rang me up and we met up at the store, and it was not for anything that was meant to go into the article. It was just because he really was going to go there and wanted to go there with me. And it was kind of astonishing, really, to see how people related to the fact that here he is just in everyday life. He's at a store that other people shop at just like you do. And even though people in New York are fairly jaded by the idea of celebrity and try not to, you know, act like they care.
They're cool about it.
Yeah. I mean, somebody of his stature in particular, and I think that just the fact that he was, you know, at least had this aura of approachability. He wasn't with any kind of entourage or bodyguard or an assistant or anything like that. So the fact that there he was just kind of out in the wild, you know, people really were a little bit flabbergasted. And as a bystander myself, I could tell you it is a little bit intoxicating that people are obviously not there to see me, they don't care, but to even have any kind of proximity to the person that they are there to see or that they are excited about, and you have to remind yourself they're not interested in you. The moment that Robin walks away, the moment that you part ways, you lose that entirely. This doesn't belong to you.
Yeah, you talk about he felt this need when he met his fans and people in public to give them a quote-unquote authentic Robin Williams experience. I wonder how much of that was also just because of the nature of the kind of stuff that he did, where he's riffing about all kinds of topics and, you know, improvising and doing characters. You talk about how well read he was and how much he informed himself so that he could just jump around from topic to topic. I wonder how much these interactions with everyday people was also about just kind of keeping the creative tool sharp.
I think maybe there was an aspect of that. And I think also that he was a person that definitely thrived on affirmation from other people and to get that back from even the people he would encounter in his everyday life was very important to him. It was satisfying to him that he, you know, these other people were happy to see him. And on some level, he knew that it took him it took him very little effort to kind of fulfill that. And that person would take that away and maybe cherish it forever. Just a 30-second or one-minute interaction is way bigger for that person. But, you know, add those seconds and minutes up over the course of a lifetime, it's a big piece of him. And that he just kind of dispensed with, I think, very willingly. And it just – but it accumulates.
You mentioned how they had put together this whole family history of Robin Williams. And I was a little surprised to read about his early life because – I don't know why, but for some reason, it goes against what I probably imagined as far as his childhood. Tell us a little about that.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that when we – I think we often think that the kind of upbringing that tends to produce comedians, there's usually more adversity. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sort of classic example, I think, would be somebody like Richard Pryor, who is literally, you know, growing up in the whorehouses of Peoria, Illinois. And that was not Robin's upbringing at all. That his family was very well off. And, you know, he did move around a bit between Illinois and Michigan because his dad was a Ford executive. So he's going where the company needs him. But very, you know, posh suburbs, and in some cases, you know, they're living in actual mansions, houses with, you know, 30 or 40 rooms and way more space than, you know, a family of two with one child needs. And, you know, his dad, you know, was descended from a kind of industrialist family from the Midwest. They already had money. His dad was a, you know, a World War II veteran and very kind of upright and, you know, kind of guy who believes in the value of a hard day's work. His mom was, I mean, literally descended from a kind of Southern aristocracy, that her great-grandfather had been a Civil War hero and both a senator and a governor of the state of Mississippi. And also, you know, there was money in that family. And by the time they had Robin, you know, the dad is often busy with work, traveling quite a bit. His mother was very much a socialite and busy with, you know, her own functions or organizing events. So Robin kind of felt like he didn't get a lot of time with them, a lot of access to them, and really craved their affirmation first and found it hard to come by. And even though, you know, in every school that he attended and, you know, he always had friends, he was popular, but he also felt very lonely. And, you know, he literally, you know, by the time they're living in this one mansion in Bloomfield Hills called Stonycroft, he was basically given, you know, the whole attic of that house to himself, where he would – that's where he played with the toy soldiers and would create these kind of massive battles with – hundreds, if not thousands, of these soldiers, and that's where he would create voices and characters for these combatants. So that, on the one hand, it became a kind of early sort of comedic laboratory for him, but it also, again, fostered that feeling of being alone, and that is something that he absolutely carried with him his whole life.
You know, I've had a lot of comics on the show, and it's often the old story of dad was strict and didn't approve of my clowning around, but mom loved it, and I just lived to entertain her and make her laugh. Does that ring true in Robin's case?
Yeah, I think that you definitely see, you know, those kind of archetypes, you know, playing out. And his mother was really quite a riot. I mean, despite her own upbringing, she had a sense of humor that was very bawdy and a little bit unpredictable, and she loved practical jokes. There's a literally like a Dick Clark Mothers Celebrities and Their Mothers special that was made in the early 80s that Robin and his mom appeared on together, and his mother on the special demonstrates this joke that she loved to do and that he sort of picked up from her, where she takes a rubber band and she cuts it, you know, in the middle so that it just kind of dangles, and she wads it up into her nostril and she sneezes so that the – basically this long rubber band is just dangling out of her nose. And that was like a bit that she taught him. And you can really clearly see the origins of Robin Williams in moments like that.
Yeah, typical Southern Belle.
Yes, exactly.
Now, how did he get
Scarlett O'Hara right yeah. there, yes.
How did he get into Juilliard? Because I don't think a lot of people realize that, but he spent, what, a semester or a year at Juilliard?
He spent 3 years at Juilliard. Okay. Yeah, he was one year shy of graduation. it's funny because we were talking about this earlier, that he gets this kind of reputation as a comedian who one day woke up and decided to become mm-hmm. a serious actor, and that's really not at all how it happened for him. And in fact, his interest in acting came first, and that's what he was very sincerely pursuing before he kind of fell backwards into comedy. That the first college he attended was Claremont College, and that's right. where he was sent. Really, his father wanted him to pursue a more sort of white-collar career, and Robin for a moment even thought he might become a diplomat. And then while he was there, he just by chance took a single improv theater course and really loved it, really excelled at it, and other students who were classmates of his absolutely verify that he just took to it with such eagerness and immediate ability, but to the point where he wasn't attending any of his other classes anymore, and just all the other work fell by the wayside, and his dad pulled him out of that school. But then he was enrolled in the College of Marin, which is a two-year community college closer to where he was living in Tiburon. But they have a fantastic theater program there. And so he's literally appearing in and then starring in local productions. He played Fagin in their production of Oliver, and you can literally read newspaper reviews of him in these shows. And he's getting great notices. And so the college at that time had a connection to John Houseman, who had just started
right.
Juilliard's drama program.
Famous Shakespearean actor who, I guess, kids today would probably know him from Trading Places.
But, I mean, I think more from Silver Spoons.
And right.
But of course,
that.
He was a colleague of Orson Welles, mm-hmm. and had a really fascinating career of his own. And so Robin had to do a proper audition and was accepted into the school. And even for a moment, because he had these previous years of training at these other colleges, they allowed him to come in as an advanced student where the premise was that he would have graduated in 2 years.
Okay.
But within that first year, they, as talented as he was, they felt like he was very undisciplined
mm-hmm.
and was not really moving at the pace that they wanted him to. And so they took him out of the advanced program and put him in a normal 4-year track. But then after those 3 years, they still felt that the discipline problems did not go away. And he was really, I think, also kind of chafing at, really how regimented and traditional their program was. And he really wanted to try other kinds of acting. Even while he was a student there, he would go out into the streets of New York and perform mime just for donations or just for the heck of it. And so it was really kind of by a mutual decision that he withdrew from Juilliard and then came back to the Bay Area to live with his parents. And that's when, San Francisco is really kind of experiencing a kind of second boom of stand-up comedy. And it was a different kind of stand-up comedy. It was not the sort of traditional man in a suit and tie at a microphone doing a kind of
tuxedo comedian Don Rickles. This was the 70s, the big comedy boom that we always talk about.
Yeah.
And you open the book by describing his early act in San Francisco. He's doing characters and voices. He's all over the place, both physically and in terms of the bits that he was doing.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like his stand-up act changed that much or had a second chapter to it like, say, a George Carlin. The early act sounds a lot like, his last comedy tour.
I understand what you mean. I think there was an evolution, though.
Really?
I think because if you look at those earliest routines, there's very little of him in them. I mean, there's a lot of just the riffing and these characters and these voices and just jumping, if you get two or three jokes out of a particular character, that's good enough. And then you move on to the next one, but you're never really seeing or even hearing him as Robin. And it wasn't mm-hmm. until later. You have to fast forward almost to a show like Live at the Met that he did in 1986, where he does start to talk more about himself and talk about the experiences of, drinking and cocaine and then becoming a father and raising a small child. It starts to get a little bit more personal. And the final tour was very much about, what we were talking about earlier, about the experiences of alcoholism and rehab and
That's
divorce.
True.
That took him a while. People forget or may not even know that he was kind of an early disciple of Richard Pryor's. A friend and really fascinated by Pryor. I mean, really considered him somebody that he could just never, compete with or measure up to. And even near the end of his life, I mean, some of the conversations that I had with him, he was still thinking about Pryor and thinking, well, that guy gave it all on stage. And how can I even do a fraction of what he did?
Yeah. And I know that Jonathan Winters was a huge influence on him. Who else did he learn from?
I mean, those are really the big two.
Those two.
He would also watch, Danny Kaye to a certain extent, who's not strictly speaking a comedian, but if you watch him in any of his movies, I mean, he also does, voices and accents and just kind of throwaway musical numbers out of nowhere. And
I can see that.
British comedians, I mean, he can discover them a little bit later, but certainly the whole Monty Python troupe and, Peter Sellers and the Goon Show, those guys. Those were slightly later discoveries, but I think those also were important influences for him.
Yeah, and speaking of Peter Sellers, I always hear people say of Peter Sellers that he was only happy when he was playing a character. I mean, he felt like he was invisible if he was just being himself. Do you find that that's a similar case with Robin? Or
I don't know if I would go quite that far, but certainly there was – I mean, there is a consistent sort of theme that crops up, and certainly earlier in his life when he's meeting his first wife, Valerie, for the first time, and he's bartending at the Holy City Zoo, and he rolls up to her, and he's talking in a French accent, and basically spends the whole night pretending to be French, and she never – it's not really until the very end of that night that she finally, gets wise to the deception. Or the first time that he's introduced to Pam Dauber when they're, shooting publicity photos for Mork and Mindy, and he meets her in the makeup trailer, and he puts on a Russian accent for her. And, it's partly to entertain these people and to get a laugh out of them. But there is a certain kind of defensiveness or a protectiveness on Robin's part that he is withholding his true self from these people. Partly, I think, in fear of being judged or being rejected. That if they met the real person and didn't like him, then what would he do?
You mentioned his first wife, Valerie, who participated in the book, and she was around for his cocaine days and his early reckless behavior.
Yeah.
What kind of insight did she bring to this?
Well, it's pretty remarkable because, she met him right before his career really exploded, meeting him, in San Francisco as he's kind of getting, connected to that comedy scene, and then going with him down to L.A. to, try to see if he can make it down there. And so on the one hand, she gets to see that rise and that kind of, rocket-like takeoff, but she never felt like she got to come on the ride with him, that she felt like, it's particularly in the sort of the social scene in LA and in Hollywood, that people were only ever interested in Robin and not in her, that he was the famous one and she wasn't, that she was somehow a kind of an impediment or a roadblock to people who wanted to get to Robin. She tells a story in the book about how when Robin signs with the management firm of Rollins Joffe, which is the
Woody Allen's managers,
exactly,
and a lot of big people.
Yeah, the real powerhouses, and that's a moment when it's clear that something big is going to happen to Robin as a result of that. That the managers take her out to lunch and they tell her, your husband's going to be a big star and he's going to be rich and you'll have lots of time to go shopping. And, that's certainly not the life that she imagined for herself.
Yeah.
She's a creative person. And at the time, she was a dancer and dance instructor and had her own, creative aspirations. And that just was never how she wanted to live.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Dave Itzkoff when we come back in just a minute. Hey guys, I want to tell you about Dollar Shave Club. Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even body wipes. Dollar Shave Club is my one-stop go-to for all of my toiletries, and I've especially become a huge fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. It smells absolutely fantastic, and it's a great way to get your day going. But all of Dollar Shave Club's products are great and made with top-shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. Plus, shipping is free with your membership. And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with Body Cleanser, One Wipe Charlie's, their amazing wipes, their world-famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month and add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need. Check it out at dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. That's dollarshaveclub.com/kickass. And I didn't know this, but wasn't it John Belushi's death that finally scared him straight and caused him to go into sobriety, sober?
That was a very big, compelling reason for him to do so, yes. And the other reason was the birth of his son, Zach, which was just a few months or about a year after Belushi's death. And, you know, certainly, I mean, again, as people may know, may not know, but, you know, Robin very infamously was with Belushi on the last night of Belushi's life, that, you know, he died the next morning in the Chateau Marmont from an overdose of, he took a speedball essentially and overdosed on that. And Robin left the room not knowing that this was about to happen to Belushi, no way realizing that something that terrible was going to occur. And it really, it scared the hell out of him. And it also, on the one hand, it lifted the veil on him to a certain extent, that anybody who to that point did not know that he was a drug abuser, there was no denying it anymore. And it also it really shook up Hollywood in the sense that there was a lot of fear now that there would be a lot more scrutiny from law enforcement, that, you know, it was kind of
interesting.
It was kind of known that, you know, people in show business, there was a lot of cocaine going around. But now the likelihood that there were going to be a lot more, raids and arrests, that sort of thing, it made it really dangerous. Yeah. And particularly by the time Valerie got pregnant and Robin knew he was going to be a father, then, I mean, he had a more sort of positive incentive to get clean, to really want to be present in his son's life and not have that kind of an impediment or that kind, you know, just not to be, abusing substances anymore.
And the first time that he went sober, he didn't do the traditional AA 12-step program,
no.
Did he? What, did he just go
cold turkey?
Cold turkey, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was effective for about, 20 years.
20 years, yeah.
When he did relapse later, he himself acknowledged that there were a lot of there were underlying things that he did not deal with the first time, and that certainly contributed to the relapse.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was his process like? You got access to this whole treasure trove of work notes that he kept.
Yeah. I mean, he archived a lot of his own correspondence and notebooks and other materials at Boston University before he died.
Huh. And what was the connection to Boston University?
It's kind of random. He was turned on to it by Terry Gilliam Gilliam had archived his material, put his archives.
Interesting.
There.
Well, yeah. Even that seems kind of random. What was Terry Gilliam's connection to Boston University?
I didn't look at it that atomically, but they have a research center there called the Gottlieb Center, which is really terrific and was a huge help to me. And I think for Robin, maybe it was somewhat, spur of the moment, or, you know, he just had a lot of stuff. They needed a place to put it. That's where it went. I'm grateful that I could access it, because they're fascinating. And they have scripts going back to literally the first episode of Happy Days that he appeared on, and stuff that predates that were, you know, his personal copies that he would mark up and annotate and, you know, make little notes or directions for himself. But particularly with the big comedy shows, the tours or the specials, and certainly with movies like Good Morning Vietnam, where there's a lot of comedy and performance involved in the role, there was a lot of preparation that he would put in terms of just, you know, he'd start basically just by working with a partner and just kind of riffing off the top of his head. And that partner could have been for a while. It was Marsha, who at the time was his personal assistant, and then he married. She was his second wife. His manager, David Steinberg, also often fulfilled this role. But he needed somebody who was writing this stuff down and keeping it organized, because he sure as heck could not do that. He was just kind of going and seeing what came out of him. And then they'd sort of look at the notes and try to put them into categories, see what kind of patterns they fell into, shape the routine out of that, whittle things down, so that essentially by the time he's going out, again, whether it's in a performance or in a movie, he has all these lines and all these bits kind of in his back pocket and ready to go. And then it's a question of just sort of when is the right moment to deploy them. So the genius is as much about coming up with things in the moment, which he could do, but it's also about doing all this preparation to make everything look spontaneous. That was part of the talent that people may not have seen or realized.
Now, you mentioned his guest appearance on Happy Days, which was his big break.
Yeah.
And that guest role, I mean, admittedly, it was sort of weird, an alien showing up in 1950s Milwaukee. But I suppose, you know, that was post-Jump the Shark Happy Days.
Yeah, that's the same season that the Jump the Shark
episode
aired.
You could get away with that stuff back then.
Yeah. Well, they really were in a creative rut at that point. Gary Marshall, you know, rest his soul. I mean, I talked to him, and I mean, he pretty much acknowledged that, like, this was only the fifth season, but they were really sort of grasping for ideas at this point. So you're right. The idea of a space alien showing up didn't seem any stranger or worse than anything else they were contemplating at the time.
And didn't Mork the Orc have something to do with Gary Marshall's son being a big Star Wars fan?
That was exactly it, that his son was about, I think, 6 or 7 at the time. And so, of course, kids at that point were totally obsessed with Star Wars. And so it was his suggestion. He just wanted to see a space alien on the show. And so that's, you know, it's a much gentler space alien. It's real. I mean, the fact that they call the episode "My Favorite Orkin" is, you know, very much a reference, of course, to "My Favorite Martian."
Sure.
There's no Darth Vader, you know, no character like that on. But it's funny, the Mork that appears in that episode is a little more malicious. You know, that the big, you know, he wants to basically, you know, steal Richie Cunningham away and bring him back to Ork because he's the most average person on Earth, so he'd make a great specimen. And then he kind of gets won over by Fonzie a little bit, becomes kind of interested in him, and then wants to steal him back. So he's a little bit more nefarious than he would be on Mork and Mindy.
And one aspect of this book that's gotten a lot of attention with the Time's Up movement is his co-star from Mork and Mindy, Pam Dauber, told you about how Robin would, I guess, grab her boobs and her butt on the set and expose himself. And yet she seems to be fairly forgiving of it and talks very fondly of him. Why? Was it just taken as that's Robin clowning around rather than some nefarious, you know, predatorial intent or what?
Well, I think there are some layers to this. You know, I think it's worth unpacking because you're right. I mean, first of all, he did behave that way to her, and that's not a way that someone should behave in any kind of professional setting, even in a you know, a TV environment. Now, with Pam, you know, she and Robin were great friends and really supported each other and looked out for each other. They were about the same age. They had both grown up in Michigan. They didn't know each other, but were, you know, from a similar part of the country, and they really had almost a kind of sibling relationship in that way. And she sensed early on that Robin had a kind of misbegotten childhood. There's another story that she relates where, you know, he's kind of, you know, acting out in some way, and, you know, just as a joke, she says to him, "Who raised you? The household help?" And he says, "Yeah."
Yeah.
And he's not kidding, that, you know, he basically saw, you know, his nanny as much as his own mother at times growing up. So, you know, they looked out for each other in that way. But Robin also, I mean, that was a way that he related, particularly to women. And people describe that also in his early stand-up acts, that sometimes he would just grab a woman's breasts out of nowhere and kind of, you know, make honking noises. And people thought it was a riot. But I think even though he may not have intended it in his interactions with Pam Dauber as a kind of a come-on or, you know, a sexual provocation, I mean, it's still, there's still a power dynamic at play. I still think it's a way of somebody who has power, somebody who is just kind of coming into his own as a star and realizing, you know, this is my show. He's doing something to her that she can't say no to, or that, you know, she can't retaliate in any way, even if he doesn't necessarily mean it that way or mean it consciously. I still think that's at play in that kind of a dynamic. And even, you know, there aren't other – I didn't come across other co-stars from later films or TV shows that, you know, had similar interactions with him. But I do think it's kind of – you know, endemic to, you know, to how people behaved in TV that way. And that doesn't mean that it's permissible.
Yeah. And it's funny because that era of Robin Williams is so indelible to me. I remember, you know, Happy Days and Mork and Mindy were my shows when I was a little kid. And I remember some of those early movies. Most people just know him as a huge movie star, but like some of those early films were a bit of a mixed bag. You had big bombs like Popeye. You know, and it almost seems like in the early, maybe the first 10 or so years of his film career, Hollywood just didn't really know what to do with him because, you know, everything that he was best at, improv and impressions and all these off-the-cuff bits, don't really translate well into a movie.
You know? No, it really was not until Good Morning Vietnam, and that's a good, you know, 5 or 6 years after Mork and Mindy gets canceled that, you know, he finally had a big, you know, commercial and critical hit. And you're right, the intervening years were very hit or miss, and some of the misses were pretty, you know, drastic to the point where, you know, basically right before he made Good Morning Vietnam, I mean, there were real questions about maybe he's not a leading man. Maybe this isn't how audiences want to see him. And it definitely got to him. I mean, he certainly, in that same period when, you know, he's having trouble kind of finding success in movies and he's watching Eddie Murphy in particular, who was, you know, having huge success with 48 Hours and Trading Places. And he looks at somebody like Murphy and is like, okay, that guy's got it figured out. He knows what to do in film, and I don't. And maybe that's just not going to be the venue or the vehicle for me.
Yeah, and his early successes like Good Morning Vietnam or like Dead Poets Society, where half the film would just be Robin being Robin and doing his shtick, and then he would start to dabble in the serious aspects when he essentially wasn't on stage in the film.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly what works so well about Good Morning Vietnam is, I mean, that in particular was a film that was very sort of deliberately developed in that way to be a kind of showcase for everything that Robin could do and to take advantage of all those different skill sets, both the sort of the comedic side and the dramatic side. And you know, Barry Levinson in particular, but other directors that Robin had success with, I mean, the ones that used him best came to understand that, you know, to get a good film performance out of him, you had to kind of give him a little bit of rope to try out some improvisations. If you're going to shoot a scene, you do a couple takes of what's in the script. You let him do a few takes of just his own improvisation or whatever he wants to do. You try to find a midpoint between them, and then you go into the editing room and you find the best take. And if he got permission or license to do that from a director, then he was usually, you know, happy and satisfied.
And yet one of my favorite movies that he ever did was Awakenings, in which I don't think there was any comedy in that. I mean, that was just a pure, straight, serious role. Was it a struggle for him to get directors to see him in that way?
I don't think so. Not by that point. I mean, there was certainly more of a fight at the very start of his film career, because if you look at the first two movies out of the gate, Popeye, which he made with Robert Altman, and The World According to Garp, which he made with George Roy Hill, both of those directors were pretty no-nonsense guys. They had done a lot of movies. You know, Hill had won Oscars by that point. Altman was pretty acclaimed and pretty, you know, pretty well known for the kinds of movies that he made. And neither one of them wanted Robin to improvise, really. I mean, it was a conflict between him and Altman on Popeye. And on Garp, I mean, the first few days of shooting, if Robin tried to improvise at all, Hill would just call cut for the day. And, you know, he's basically teaching Robin the lesson very early on: this is my set and not yours. Little by little, you know, Robin started to earn that right or win Hill over some more. But it was something that Robin always desired on all of his films, and the more successful he became and the more of a known quantity he became, directors certainly understood that of him.
He had this massive run in the 90s, culminating with winning an Oscar for Good Will Hunting. And then, as if it's sort of flipping a switch, after the turn of the millennium, things start to fall apart again for him. He starts drinking again. His marriage of 20 years ends. What was the catalyst for all that?
Well, I think it's just it's so many things. It's not really any one thing that I think you can point to. Certainly, you know, his relapse occurred, depending on how you want to measure it, somewhere in the early 2000s. And by that point, he'd experienced a lot of loss. His mother died in 2001, and that was certainly tough on him. He starts losing friends like Christopher Reeve and Richard Pryor,
right,
who he has seen go through fairly debilitating illnesses and conditions. Reeve, of course, was paralyzed in the horseback riding accident, and Pryor had MS, and a couple other friends that he also saw die, and so that was very tough on him. It's also a period where he's making some very dark movies, things like One Hour Photo and Insomnia. I mean, playing characters who either were outright serial killers or people who wanted to try to commit awful crimes.
Yeah.
And he did a lot of immersive kind of study of like actual tapes of confessions from serial killers to try to pick up on their qualities. Some of these movies, like Insomnia and another one called The Great White, he's literally filming in like these very remote locations, either in like remote parts of Canada or the Yukon, Alaska. So oftentimes he'd be by himself and only with, his makeup artist and his assistant are the only people he knows in the production. And he's just kind of melancholy about his career or about his life in general. And he starts to fall back into these kinds of old patterns of behavior where, when he would perform stand-up, particularly, in the 70s and in the Hollywood era, it wasn't just that he would go out and do a bunch of shows, but he would go to the clubs and then afterwards would just go out all night and party and drink a lot, do drugs, hook up with other women. And so in a sense, that behavior is still very much ingrained in him to some degree, that he still knows that that's a way that he can make himself feel good. So that's when he starts to drink again.
I remember when he finally took the role on the CBS series. I forget the name of it.
The Crazy Ones.
The Crazy Ones. I remember when that happened, people said that he was just doing it for the money, and I started to hear that he was having all these financial troubles.
I don't think there's real.
Was that true? Yeah.
I don't think there's really evidence that, he was hard up for cash in that way. I think it has more to do with the fact that he lived a certain lifestyle, and certainly by the time he was making The Crazy Ones, he was married again. He had just gotten married for the third time in 2011, and I think wanted his wife to enjoy a certain way of living, feel like, he was really pampering her in some way. And in order to do that, I mean, you certainly need, a pretty steady stream of income. And that was part of what The Crazy Ones was, intended to do for him and that he hoped would do. That, I think he was paid something on the order of like $150,000 an episode for that. So, in a 22-episode season, you can do okay. And, it was a David E. Kelly show. So on paper, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
on CBS, where at least as a network, they kind of have a reputation for sort of reinventing or reinvigorating, people from past eras of TV history.
Yeah.
But to watch the show, I mean, you could really see how it was just not the right vehicle for him. He was trying and he wasn't operating at 100% anymore, but the energy was, a lot of it was still there, but it just, I don't know if it was just the single camera aspect of it. There was no laugh track, and you hear him cracking jokes or, riffing with the other cast members, and then just silence, just kind of dead air or incidental music, but no reinforcement from an audience. It just didn't work that way.
Now, I mentioned that it's, I guess, almost 4 years since his suicide in August. When it happened, a lot of people assumed that it was drug or alcohol related, and it sounds like the family has been somewhat eager to set the record straight on this.
I think it's tough for them because it, of course, caught them all off guard, even though they knew that he was suffering at that time. But I think it was very hard to kind of go into public and tell people what had occurred, because beyond the sort of you know, the initial, a police report and a statement, you know, from his widow at the time. I mean, there was the initial statement from his widow made reference to the fact that he had been battling depression recently. So I think a lot of people, understandably or however, I mean, they took that to mean that somehow, you know, he was just really upset with his life in some way, and that's why he did it. Then a few days later, there was another statement from his widow, and it was also true that in his own lifetime, he had been given a diagnosis of Parkinson's disease, and he was experiencing a lot of the symptoms that are, you know, that Parkinson's sufferers do exhibit in terms of motor problems, physical
The tremors.
Stiffness and posture problems, that sort of thing. So I think the people then sort of drew the conclusion, oh, okay, he knew he had something that was going to be progressive and debilitating, and so he didn't want to live through that, and that's why he did it. And it wasn't until many months later, after his autopsy, and in fact some of his brain tissue was analyzed, and they found evidence of what's called Lewy body disease, which is...
What is that? I've never heard of that.
Yeah, it's somewhat akin to Parkinson's in that both of them come from a buildup of proteins in your brain that usually, you know, your brain would produce in a normal level, but in excess, they become toxic. And so with Parkinson's, that's attacking, again, the motor part of the brain primarily. With Lewy body, it's also attacking other parts of your brain that have to do with just judgment and perception and rational thought.
Interesting.
And so the people who have this, they can also experience just really, really high, like, anxiety and paranoia. Some people have hallucinations. There's often, you know, very wild kind of mood swings associated with it. Some people, and people certainly felt like they saw Robin experience this, people will kind of just seem to shut down, where they just will sit and not react to anything and they don't talk. You can kind of look at them and see that a light is on, but they're just not interacting or responding to things. So, you know, given that, there are, you know, friends of Robin's, people who saw him in those last weeks, who retrospectively feel like they had encounters with him that they thought maybe that was his way of trying to kind of, you know, settle accounts with them or say goodbye in some way. But there's no way to know, you know, conclusively if he even, you know, in those last moments, like, you know, knew exactly what he was doing or knew that he was himself. And it's hard. I know, you know, we'd all like closure on this. We would really like a kind of, you know, A results in B kind of answer to it. And I don't know that we will ever really have a kind of clear resolution on it.
There are a lot of unanswered questions with Robin. And for you, who actually spent some time with him and interviewed him over the years, there must have been some moments while you were researching this book when you just felt like you could have kicked yourself because you wished that you had had the presence of mind to ask him about this or that when you had the chance.
Absolutely. I mean, even just banal things like, I mean, it's funny. One question that I'm often asked was like, what of all the movies that he made, what was his favorite? And I don't have an answer to that. I wish I had asked him that. I imagine that answer might have changed at different times in his life. But even to be able to know that concretely is sort of like, oh, why didn't I ask him something that simple when I had the opportunity?
What did you most want to ask him if you could have?
That's probably it. I mean, there's other stuff that I think is maybe a little retrospectively. It might be a little salacious. I mean, I think the second divorce, I have to believe, was especially hard on him. I know that he really continued to nurse a broken heart after that, even though, you know, he was a mutual partner to that decision. It wasn't totally forced on him. But Marcia, his second wife, was so hugely intertwined in his life, and not just, you know, organizing him day to day, but really had, you know, a lot of impact on just how he chose material, trying to help, you know, guide scripts to him, keep certain mm-hmm. things away. I mean, she was a producer on Mrs. Doubtfire and really helped
right.
find that book and shape right. the screenplay. You know, she definitely deserved a lot of credit for how it turned out. And, you know, to lose somebody that is that instrumental and that sort of interwoven into your life, I have to imagine was, you know, just a massive change in his life. And it's something I really didn't understand until mm-hmm. you know, after his death and after speaking to, you know, people that knew him well and saw, you know, how the two of them worked and lived together. I didn't understand that at the time.
Yeah. Well, before we go, you followed him on tour for quite a bit, but apparently you were never allowed in his dressing room, and no one was during the 30 or 40 minutes before a performance.
Yeah.
What do you think he did in there?
I'll never know. And it's so interesting because, yeah, I mean, you could conjure up all kinds of things. Is that, you know, did he spend those last 30 minutes kind of meditating and just clearing his mind and getting into kind of a Zen state? Or maybe he just did that on purpose to kind of cultivate mm-hmm. a mystique about, ooh, you know, what is Robin doing in there by himself? We just don't have that answer. And I thought it was, you know, there's something the metaphor of it is pretty obvious, yeah. but I felt like I had to relate that.
Well, again, the book is called Robin. Dave Itzkoff, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks once more to Dave Itzkoff for coming on the show. Order his book, Robin, on Amazon or Audible. Read more by Dave Itzkoff in the New York Times and follow Dave on Twitter at @DItzkoff. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.